5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelt quicker, pronounced cooker, 100 degrees boiling hot water, straight from your kitchen tap. Also, it now does chilled, sparkling, filtered water too. Woohoo! Today is another special. Today is a conversation with Mr. Simon Eccles. Now, Mr. Simon Eccles is Clinical Director of Children's and Young People's Services and President of the Plastic Surgery Section of the Royal Society of Medicine. He's basically a plastic surgeon and a fascinating man. And I think you're thoroughly going to enjoy this because we go through discussing everything about plastic surgery from
the history of stuff in the war, you know, its role in the war, its benefits and positive side, but also it was, you know, the dangers of what you call cowboys, you know, people, unqualified people doing it, fillers and Botox and the dangers of that, really, wasn't it, as well?
We must point out that Simon's really big on trying to get regulation in place because he's having to treat, you'll hear it in the podcast, he's having to treat people who have had bad jobs done there. And we discuss things like Botox parties on it. And a Botox party is where, and I hear about people going to these, someone turns up to a group of people, they've had a drink, and then everyone says, come on, let's do some Botox, and everyone has a little injection. And, you know, he thinks this sort of stuff should be regulated. But, you know, you can hear him explain it. And also, there is a lot of discussion about women. We all know men have it done. We discuss me on it as well. But it seems to be that women do a lot of these Botox parties. Yeah. It seems to be the thing. But we are aware that both men and women
do have plastic surgery and cosmetic surgery. And so, yeah, we just want to make that point.
Okay, so this is fascinating. I hope you enjoy it. This is Mr. Simon Eccles.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Simon, welcome to my kitchen. Thank you very much for joining us today. I've got you a present. I get everyone a present. I bought you a bottle of red wine.
Fantastic.
Do you like wine?
Definitely.
Okay.
Shall I open it now?
No, it's fine. Just there. What do you? How is wine for your body? Is it okay? What's the latest thinking on that?
Well, I mean, that's a good point because, you know, Monday it's good for you. Tuesday the chief medical says don't drink, it causes cancer. Wednesday everyone's back on it again. I mean, I think a little of that, a little of what your fancy does, you're good to be quiet. All things in moderation, but I think, you know, you look at the Italians or Mediterranean, they eat lots of nice fruit, veg, a bit of red wine, doesn't do them any harm, so go for it.
I sort of have this theory, and it's my own theory, but that the fruit, I think mainly fruit for me, but fruit and vegetables are things that make my skin good.
Yeah.
Could that be true? I mean, we all know about the vegetable things, but I just always think the fruit is good for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of, I mean, vitamin C, which is a coenzyme you need to make collagen, you need to repair your skin, all that sort of stuff. The zinc, there's all these essential elements. You don't need to take vitamins or anything else at all because everything natural has enough stuff in it. I mean, people like to buy vitamins and stuff, but it goes in the top end and comes out the bottom end. So
yeah, you were just saying that because you were looking at, I had a sort of thing of...
There's three stories. I've never seen so many. It's like a chemist shop.
I've got some collagen, like a powder thing there that was given to me. I've only done it once or twice, but you're saying it's just pointless.
Well, your body makes collagen and it makes its own specific collagen. So, you know, this is not going to be absorbed in your gut, and that's the only way it's going to get into your body. So eat all the stuff that you need to make collagen, which is nice fruit, vegetables, and vitamin C, and your body will make it naturally.
The one thing that I've been doing recently is I've been giving blood, and they told me last time it takes me 3 months or something to make up back my iron or something like that.
Yeah.
However, by the way, you should all go and give blood because it's a great cause, and the amount of people who tweet me afterwards saying my kid needs it for his cancer or her cancer or whatever treatment. Thing is, I feel $1 million after it. It's like you just feel amazing. You get really high off it. I don't know why that is.
Well, I guess psychologically doing something. I mean, you're giving your own half a litre of personally made valuable drugs, because the actual blood is, it's got red cells, it's got all sorts of stuff in it. And it's a fantastic, you're giving an organ transplant to somebody basically, aren't you? You're giving a bit of yourself. So I think that's a psychological bit.
Right.
I don't know about the rest of it. I don't know, a lot of people feel like that because it's quite a nice atmosphere when you're doing it. Everybody else is doing it. It's a nice club, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, you feel good about it.
Yeah, you do, yeah.
And I think it's a great thing to do. You know, still now in hospitals, you know, people race around for blood. There's not enough blood. You can't get it, trauma things. Mm. So go for it.
Let's find out about you then. Tell us about yourself. You started off as a dentist, didn't you?
I did. I was going to do medicine, actually, but I didn't get the grades. So I had to resit my A-levels. Actually, I got... the second time round, I'd been at boarding school, and I went back home to see my parents and went to Rotherham Technical College, which I have to say sounds bad, but it was brilliant. They really looked after me. And I thought perhaps I'd do dentistry, because I was really like doing practical things, making things or doing things or whatever. And I did it. I got a place to do both. I did dentistry. Pretty much, I had lots of mates who were medics. And as soon as I qualified, I thought, really, actually, that's what I want to do. So I then got a place. I did a couple of years of oral surgery, then back to do medicine. And actually, I'm a craniofacial plastic surgeon. So really what I do is kids and adults who've got facial deformities or head and neck cancer or whatever. And I do some aesthetic surgery as well. And I love it, actually. It's brilliant.
So what's the difference? What's aesthetic surgery? That's for people who got nothing wrong with them, but want...
Pretty much. You want a smaller nose, bigger boobs, tighter face, all that sort of thing, or cosmetic surgery, really.
Do you do the sort of everything? Do you go all the way down to the bum implants and things like that?
No, I don't do any of that. I do facial aesthetic surgery. I do some body contouring and breasts, but I don't do anything else. I mean, in fact, you know, a lot of those other procedures that people read about and it seems low risk are not low risk at all. You know, and in fact, this country, the Brazilian butt lift, all those things have been banned, actually, because several people have died having those procedures. So it may look quite simple and straightforward. You see people in the media having these things done, but it isn't. So I think you have to be very wary of that sort of stuff, actually.
All right, we'll go on to that a bit later. But do you enjoy your job? Do you enjoy medicine?
I love medicine.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it. It's brilliant. I like teaching other doctors. I like... work with my patients, like everything about it.
Okay. Plastic surgeons are sort of frowned upon, though, aren't they? Because you're all lumped into one.
Yeah.
And then you have these strange people like the Catwoman or you have Katie Price's forever growing and shrinking boobs. And people go, why are they doing that to them? And so you all get lumped in together.
Yeah. I think that's very true. And if you say plastic surgeon, it doesn't matter that you're building children's faces or whatever, they think all you're doing is sticking boobs in and sucking fat out. And, you know, plastic surgery in some ways is the last big general specialty because it includes burn surgery and hand surgery and all that sort of stuff. But you're right. You know, there are some terrible cowboys in this country that people come from abroad operating here. Patients get sort of sucked into going abroad and having surgery abroad and then coming back with complications. Not all of it's bad, but you tend to hear about the bad things because they hit the press.
So how often would you turn someone away?
For an aesthetic surgery procedure, I should think every clinic I do, I turn one patient away for something or other.
Really? Yeah. And how do they react to that?
Well, I don't do free consultations because I think a lot of people do that hoping to suck patients in. I don't think that doesn't work for me.
Right.
So actually, often by the time they come, my PA's done lots of talking, investigation, would have discussed things with them. So sometimes actually, they don't make the appointment. But people do come and they say, I want to look like this, or I want a nose like that. And actually, they're very often people who are intelligent and got lots of ideas about what they want to be, but they may not have the right, the way they perceive themselves is not how everybody else would. So there may be a degree of body dysmorphia.
Yeah.
The difficult thing is if that's the case and you get somebody who comes to see you and say, well, surgery's not going to help you, then they'll say, I'll go and find somebody else. Well, that's fine, but so long as you're not adding to their problems, that's fine. But trying to convince them to go and see psychologists, because actually some of those patients with some psychological support, cognitive behavioural therapy or whatever, are transformed, actually. You can make huge differences. But there is a group of patients that think, well, I still that patient, that person on the telly, and they've got a big boobs, or if I would look like that, I'd be the same. And they will seek out people and get the surgery. So I think, I'm not saying I'm super scrupulous, or I try to be, but a lot of people are not scrupulous at all and just see the pounds, shillings and pence. A lot of these cosmetic companies, you go and see them for a consultation, and there's a hard sell. You may not even see a doctor. You may just see somebody else who talks them about surgery. And by the time they've got home, I know this, I've seen patients who've done this, you know, the clinics run them 10 times, say, well, we could offer you a deal, we could get you a loan, all this right. sort of stuff. They feel so worn down. They say, oh, just, okay, do it, just to stop bringing me up. So I think there's quite a lot of intimidation and bullying, actually, into patients having things as well.
Is there enough regulations in place?
No, not at all. A few years ago, we looked at regulation for the non-surgical market, because that's the biggest market now. That's about $3.75 billion a year. Fillers and Botox is more than your salary, Tim.
$2.75 billion. I'm on TV.
But, you know, the surgical markets are only about $250 million. So actually, it's much smaller. And actually, we wanted to get regulation for Botox and fillers, who people think are low risk. I mean, they're low risk unless you get the complications, then they can be devastating. But the government gets VAT for those procedures. It's difficult because they're not on prescription. People buy them on the internet. There are increasing numbers of people offering regulation. A lot of the best practitioners, and the best practitioners are not necessarily doctors, they're people who've trained properly how to do it. They come from all different sort of avenues. But, you know, people think, well, if I go to a party and have a few glasses of Prosecco and somebody sticks a needle in my face, it's probably okay, but it probably isn't okay.
Do you have to fix these then?
Oh, yeah.
Explain to us, what is Botox? It's some sort of poison, isn't it? And what is fillers? What's actually happening?
Okay, so Botox is a toxin, botulinum toxin made from a bacteria. It's produced in a sterile way. And actually, it's injected in small amounts into the muscles, particularly around the eyes, to weaken those muscles so it gets rid of wrinkles. And actually, it's very clever the way it was discovered, because there's an ophthalmologist and her husband who's a dermatologist, and she was injecting it for patients who've got a condition called blepharospasm, which is where sometimes, you know, when you get tired, your eye twitches.
Yeah.
And you may not be able, nobody can see it, but it feels awful. So she injected it for these patients, and her husband said, well, that's really good. All the wrinkles have disappeared. So that was about 15 years ago. So people realize in tiny little amounts. And it works actually not by damaging the muscle. It works by blocking the receptor. So the nerve gets stimulated. Normally the receptor acts and the muscle twitches. It stops that stops the muscle from contracting, and it wears off again because you then get more receptors made and the muscle starts to work again. It takes about three up to 6 months to work. But you need to make sure if somebody's injecting in your face, it is Botox. There was a famous case last year in Bournemouth where this guy bought something from the internet. He saw some people and injected them. Some people were okay. Some people had terrible complications. One of these people said, I'm going to report you to the GMC, which is the General Medical Council, which is like the, you know, where doctors get struck off and disciplined. And he said, fine, I'm not a doctor. It doesn't matter. Okay, report to the nurse's unit. I'm not a nurse. And actually, the only way they could actually get him was by assault for doing something that, you know, sticking a needle in them without their permission, although really they had. So it's very difficult to prove,
So surely you need some sort of qualification to do it.
Well, you're absolutely right. And just to answer your other point, what is a filler? So Botox is a toxin.
Can I just go back to Botox very quickly before we move on?
Yeah.
I was told by a skin doctor that I know that he was one of the first guys around to use it, and he was using it for the twitches
blepharospasm.
And when he realized it was being used for cosmetic reasons, he thought, oh, this is really dangerous, this is really bad. But then he said, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of it being bad. And he said he's sort of been proved wrong. Is that still the case? Do we think it's bad, or do we not have enough evidence yet?
We have no evidence for the majority of patients that having Botox and repeated Botox causes any long-term damage or harm. The only things that have been proven is a couple of patients have had allergy, and that's probably to the preparation and not the Botox itself. And actually had a patient, this happened to me, that if you're prone to cold sores or things like that, it could bring out zoster. You know, you get shingles on your face because it's just a trauma of having something, but as a visit to the dentist could. But there's no other long-term evidence that causes problems. We use Botox in other things. So children who have seizures and clonic tonic seizures where they're contracting their muscles, and actually it's very painful for them, using bigger doses for those people to relax the muscles. So here, using tiny, tiny amounts.
So why is it take the wrinkles away? What's actually happening there then?
Okay, well, you get a wrinkle where you have a muscle and you have skin creases perpendicular. So my brow, and I lift up my brow, you can see I've got creases here. That's because the frontalis muscle is lifting up like that, and the skin is wrinkling in a horizontal way, a bit like those Austrian blinds. Yeah, you've got no wrinkles at all.
No, I have got.
Oh, yeah, they've come up. Yeah, I can see them now. But so actually, as the muscle lifts up, the skin sort of contracts. So if you put Botox in, it stops the muscle from working. But if you do it nicely, you can just get rid of a few wrinkles around here and a few around the eyes, and you can still move your forehead. That's sort of completely, you know, I can't move anything at all look is very unattractive.
Yeah.
Some people like it. I mean, you know, it's not something I go for with my patients or my patients want, but actually for rejuvenating the area around the eye, it's much better than any surgery. It's done nicely. It looks naturally. It's a really good treatment. And it's something the patient doesn't have to go into hospital for. If you've got somebody who you rely on and you trust and doing it in a proper way, then it's really good treatment. It works really, really
well. But it only works for 6 months, 3 to 6 months.
3 to 6 months, yeah.
Yeah, so it's something I should be doing.
I couldn't possibly say.
All right, what's a filler then?
So a filler is to add volume where you've got a bit of deflation. So for example, ladies particularly feel as they get older, their lips get a bit thinner, or actually young ladies like to have bigger lips. Mm. So filler is, most of them are made of a compound called hyaluronic acid. And if you look at your body, the cells are glued together with hyaluronic acid, but this is produced artificially. And there are different forms, there are different makes, Restylane, Volume, all sorts of different makes and different compositions. And the composition relies on how big the particles are. So if it's very fine, small particles, you can use that for enhancing what's called the red line, which is the outline of your lip, for getting a bit more lip shape. If it's thicker than that, bigger particles, you can use it for enhancing your cheeks.
Dangerous?
Dangerous. I mean, I probably this year I've operated on 7 or 8 patients who've had complications from filler, one of whom was a girl who literally was at home, somebody came to filler party, stuck it in her eye, she, oh, that's a bit painful, got a red eye, and actually we did an MRI and she had a blob of filler about the size of a marble, actually just almost in her eye socket, so been injected, which, you know, is very dangerous because she could get orbital cellulitis and that could lead to visual problems and blindness. People do it, they don't prepare the skin, they may not be cleaning the needles properly, so you get little abscesses. Had people with pus draining out of their lips from having infected filler, asymmetry. Had one patient a couple of years ago who had it injected near to her nose and had agonizing pain, and the person that did it didn't recognize what that was, but they'd obviously inject it into an artery, and the sidewall of her nose necrosed and her lip necrosed, and she left with terrible scarring. So
what does necrosed mean?
So dead, so the tissue dies
right
off. So you know, you lose that, so your nostril retracts up, your lip all becomes very scarred, and it's permanent scarring.
Why aren't they regulating it then? Why? Because you guys must be going, come on, regulate this. Then why aren't they listening to you?
Well, we did with the chief medical officer a few years ago, went through a whole sort of thing about how could we regulate it. And actually, of course, the non-aesthetic or the non-surgical people say, well, you just want to control it because, you know, if only doctors can give it, that stops us. You're going to make all the money. Actually, I don't think anybody really gives a stuff about that. What people want is that it's done properly to protect the patients. So a lot of practitioner groups have come together now. There's a group called, I'm going to get this wrong, it's not called Let's Face It, but it's something like that. There's another group, the Joint Council on Cosmetic Treatments or something, which are very, very credible. And they say that if you've done the right training, they'll give them a sort of certificate, they'll give them an accreditation to say you've reached the standard to do it. Of course, a little bit it relies on people going and saying, you know, have you had done this before? But actually, patients often are not as discriminating as that. Mm. You know, till recently, Groupon and Woucher and all these people would say, go and have Botox, you know, £50 for whatever. And for a lot of people, the price point is the strongest factor, not who's doing it.
Okay, so how much should it be costing if you're going to go for a pro like you? What are the sort of range you're looking at?
Well, I mean, for a region, for an area, I'll probably charge a lot more. I can hear the oohs and ahs as I start, but I charge about £200 an area.
Right.
So, but I think even more than that, because you'll get people charging more, still not. It's actually saying, have you done this before? Have you had any complications? What training have you had? And I think a lot of people don't feel empowered to do that. And if you've had a few drinks and all your mates are having, you probably just do it. You feel too embarrassed to ask. But I think, remember, you're having something injected in your body that is a drug that has possible complications.
Yeah.
The worst complications of filler, and there have been 5 or 6 in the world literature, people who had it injected around the eye. It gets into the little veins, drains the back of your eye, you go blind. And there have been 5 or 6 cases of blindness through filler being injected, particularly in this area here, the tear trough area,
right,
particularly the temporal area here. So I think you've got to be super careful.
For people listening to that, Simon's pointing to the area underneath the eye. And the price is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because everyone's watching Love Island, and for some reason, everyone wants to look like the people. Well, it's fashion, isn't it? Beauty is fashion. There used to be a time as, does my bum look big in this? Now it's, how do I make my bum bigger? You know, so beauty comes in waves in fashion.
Yeah,
at the moment, the big lip thing is really in, and the Botox. Even people I know, girls, women who are taking Botox, and they don't have any wrinkles, to stop it happening in the future.
Which it won't do.
Won't it?
No. It won't do. I mean, you're paralysing the muscle, but in fact, as soon as it starts working again, it's not going to... You know, the wrinkle is a product of how you looked after your skin, how thick the dermis is, you know, what you do with your face. Actually, as soon as it wears off, it starts again. So that's a myth, really. It won't do that. But also, it's a bit like the Brazilians in the 70s, where people used to have incisions made on their faces, so people thought they'd had plastic surgery when they hadn't, bizarrely. I mean, how weird
really?
Is that? Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Brazil, of course, was the center of plastic surgery for many years. But I think people have Botox now. Say, oh, yeah, I have Botox.
Yeah.
Whereas it's a thing to do, you know. It's like, you know, it's just a fashion thing to say that you're doing it, but probably they don't need it. And a lot of people are probably having little dribs and drabs that aren't doing anything at all, but paying for it because, oh, yeah, the Botox costs this and all this. And
it's
that reverse snobbery about it, you know. Mm. You don't have Botox, do you? No, of course. Where people are dying for you to ask them that they're having it and... You know,
yeah.
I think there's all that side to it. And I think it's just not without its problems. You know, the non-cosmetic market is also things like some of these weird, wacky laser treatments, which also can cause problems. You can cause burning to your face. You can lose fat volume. And every week I see patients who've had some weird and wacky treatment. And often they cost thousands of pounds, these.
Mm.
And people think they go in, it's a lunchtime fix, and they'll be fine, whether it's a thread lift or whatever. Actually, the result probably lasts about as long as lunchtime, but their bank balance is depleted forever, you know.
Well, one of the ones that I heard about recently was liposuction, however you say it, that actually it's a stupid idea because when you get fat, Dr. Giles Yeo was on here, when you get fat, it's your fat cells getting fatter.
Yeah.
Now, by taking fat cells away, which is what you're doing, it doesn't... You've still got the fat ones
still
there.
Got the fat,
And what you're doing is you're just taking away valuable cells.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of stem cells in fat cells, and people who transfer fat around will tell you that, and so they bump their prices up. But you know, fat is an amazing substance. We just tend to think it's yellow amorphous stuff that lines our bodies. But when you're young, you have fat on your back that actually, as it's metabolized, generates heat. You know, we know that patients who have thyroid eye disease, the thyroid hormones produce these very prominent eyes. We know patients who take drugs, say, for HIV, get lipoastrophy. So it's a very complex substance. There's obviously lots of different receptors on it. But you're right, you know, you can liposuck fat. People say, well, that's great, I'll never get fat there. But of course, you put on weight, the existing or the fat cells that are left just get bigger.
Mm.
So, you know, you can't remove the fat forever. It can be good if you've lost weight and you've got a difficult area. You know, you've got sort of love handles in men or that sort of area. There's something that you've exercised hard and you just can't shift it. And I think it's quite useful for those sort of things. But it's never a thing to lose weight. Again, it's one of those things that actually you should be careful having it done because actually if you do it improperly, you can get rippling, you can get unevenness. You know, I saw a lovely lady last week who looks like somebody's sort of stabbed her in the abdomen because somebody's liposucked the centre and not done the outside. She's lost weight. She's got like a sort of big divot there now. So, you know, you have to be careful about what you're doing.
And people are going abroad for these treatments.
Yeah.
It's, what's it called? Cosmetic tourism.
Cosmetic tourism, yeah.
Is that a bad idea?
Well, again, you know, there are some fantastic, you know, people go to Turkey for their nose. There's actually some of the best rhinoplasty surgeons now around are in Turkey, so it's fine. But actually, when you go to Turkey, you may not be seeing those. You may be seeing somebody else. I think, you know, the case that stands out for me about that is a lady who went to Brazil and had butt implants in. Mm. 2 days later, she was sitting on a beach with her wounds and everything, thinking it was okay. She came back to the UK unwell, came through to the Chelsea and Westminster. There was sort of pus coming out through her buttocks. Oh. We admitted her, took the implants out. She was in ITU for a couple of days. And actually, when we saw her afterwards, she said, well, thanks very much to save my life. But, you know, when's the operation? I said, what operation? When are you going to put them back in?
And, wow.
You know, so, you know, there's that sort of, whoa, you know. I think you have to be so super careful. If you go to America, if you go to some parts of Europe, yeah, there are great people, but you have to stay and go through the whole thing and do the recovery program. You can't just dip in and out of those things and think, I'll combine a holiday with surgery, because it is surgery. You know, your body's got to heal. You're liable to get infections. You're liable to have those sort of complications, deep vein thrombosis. And just because it's a cosmetic operation doesn't mean you're not going to get complications. And if you do, they're not going to be want to, you know, cover you, because often their clinics close at 5 o'clock. There's nobody there. Everyone's gone home. You know, you come back to the UK, the NHS mops these things up, and there's been quite a lot in the press about it. We did a survey about this, finding that, you know, a lot of hospitals every week they're getting people in. And you could argue that those people are taking the beds of people who should be having other operations on waiting lists and things. Mm. I don't think all of it is bad, but I think people have just got to do their homework about what they're having.
We're talking about the cosmetic stuff here, but you are a plastic surgeon, and plastic doesn't mean bits that you're putting bits of plastic in people, which is what everyone thinks. No. Does it? What does plastic mean?
It's Greek. It means to move or shape, plastikos. Right. So you know, from the original, I mean, plastic. So the original plastic surgeon was 600 AD, the Sushruta, who was an Indian guy, who reconstructed people's noses by taking tissue from the forehead, which seems a bizarre thing to do, but we do a modification of that now, and it's still a very good nasal reconstruction. But the most recent plastic surgeons people have heard of are people like Harold Gillies in the First World War and Archibald McIntosh, McIndoe in the Second World War in the Guinea Pig Club. They were real plastic surgeons. They were people who'd been in the Second World War, people who'd been fighter pilots who'd been burned and had terrible facial injuries, hideous facial injuries. And they went to East Grinstead Hospital and he rebuilt their faces for them.
Yeah, I suppose war is a time where you get a medicine kicks in and you learn a lot, but you're stretched a lot, obviously.
You're stretched a lot.
But you learn a lot because you've got to do stuff quickly.
I think you've got to make big decisions about things, and it's life saving and limb saving and then face saving, probably in that order, really.
Mm. You're also what's your secretary and trustee of charity Facing the World?
Yes, Facing the World.
That's a great charity, because tell us about it. You might as well.
Well, Facing the World, it was set up by a couple of plastic surgeons, Norma Waterhouse and Martin Kelly, and Martin sadly died. But it was set up really because Martin, when he was training, did lots of training all around the world and saw that there were lots of kids who had facial deformities who were sort of shunned. You know, they were the people that were put outside the village. People thought they were devil children. And as a consequence, their families were also shunned. And often they didn't need massively complex surgery to help them. So he set up a charity with some friends and started off by bringing kids to the UK. And over the years, we brought lots of kids. We had two Siamese twins joined head to head that we brought to the UK, and we separated them. We had children from Kabul, from Afghanistan, and built them faces, really, so they could go back home and have normal lives, really. And, you know, we had a girl from Haiti as a friend of mine, David Knott, who's a trauma surgeon. He brought a little girl from Haiti who'd been in a hospital that had collapsed, and she lost an arm. She was only, you know, about 6 months old. She had terrible head injuries, and we brought her over here and got her to heal. So it was really humanitarian things to try and you know, give people a chance. Actually, we've changed a bit now, because rather than bringing the kids over, which is expensive, we now go to Vietnam, and when we go over there, we teach the doctors. We bring the doctors over here and teach them.
Okay.
They've been there for about 11 years now. It's fantastic, actually. Really amazing.
And is that things like cleft palates and things like that?
It is a bit. I mean, we do that, but there's lots of really good cleft charities. There's Operation Smile and Smile Train, but these are children with facial clefts or conditions like Apert's syndrome, where the skull is fused, which restricts the growth of the brain and the face. So we remodel the skulls and remodel the faces over a series of operations. But we're teaching the doctors there to do it. They're brilliant doctors. They just haven't got the infrastructure. So it's a long-term commitment. It's not just, right, we're going to go in and we'll never see you again. You see that child the next year, you see how they're growing, and we're teaching them how to look after these people.
So you've got your job so surreal in one way, because you've got this happening where you're helping these children, and then you've got probably people coming in going, you see this tiny bit on my, you yeah. know.
Or, I remember that consultation.
Yeah, yeah. These must be quite surreal.
It is, but you know, medicine is fantastic because it encompasses all sorts of different things. Mm. And I think you use different parts of your brain. I mean, you know, doing the aesthetic stuff and doing it nicely and doing it well, hopefully patients buy into what you're doing, and that allows you to go and spend some time giving your time for free doing other things. But you know, if you're reconstructing a child's face or taking a tumor out, you don't have to make a big slash down here. You can do a facelift incision. So the techniques are very interchangeable. You can use them for all different sorts of things. If you're, you know, if you're reconstructing somebody's face or doing something, then use the same techniques. There's nothing distinct about them. If you're rebuilding a nose, you're not going to make a blob. You want to make it look a nose. So use the techniques you'd use if you're doing aesthetic surgery. It's not different. It's more difficult often because you're missing vital bits. You have to make them or generate them or do something. But, you know, that makes it more fun, really.
How rapidly is the industry moving since you first started? How long have you been in it, doing it?
I've been a consultant now since 2004.
So how quickly has it been moving?
I think amazingly. I think what's really, well, in different ways, I think from a reconstructive point of view, we are much more clever about tissue engineering. I think we know now how tissues heal. We're able to use stem cells. We're starting to be able to grow spare bits of tissue for patients. We can also print them. You know, we print cheekbones, we print orbital implants. I've been operating on a group of children who've got a condition called neurofibromatosis, where the brain pushes into the eye socket. We've been making printed implants to separate the brain. So all these sort of things, which you reduce the time of the surgery, reduce the success rate, and so the kids get better more quickly. And from the aesthetic market, I think what's really happened there is the surgery, you know, if you look at year on year, people are having less facelifts. They're having less of these big, long procedures, particularly in the UK. And we call them tweakments. They want tweakments, you know, they want. I know, it's great, isn't it?
That's brilliant, yeah.
And they do want, you know, something that's perhaps not as harsh as a facelift, but a bit more rejuvenation.
Yeah.
And I think if those things are done well and nicely, then actually that's good. You know, people feel better about themselves, and sometimes a bit of both. Sometimes it's a bit of surgery and a bit of Botox as well, or something like that. Mm. And I think that market has grown. The difficulty, you started off to ask me about it, is that it's just not really regulated. And so, you know, all the time I work with BAPRAS, the British Association of Plastic Surgeons. We're always looking at people's credentials, the stuff they put on their websites, and oftentimes people just make them up. Sometimes they're not even registered to on the specialist register, which you have to be a doctor doing plastic surgery. That these people aren't at all. They may be registered to do foot surgery, you know. But, you know, I think patients don't feel that they have a voice to be able to ask these people. They feel embarrassed, and actually, you know, that's terrible as well. There's no, you know, you can go and look people up, and sometimes people say, I looked you up and whatever. But I think oftentimes people just turn up and think, well, that's a bit cheaper than the last one. We'll go for this one, really.
Yeah.
And that may not give them, it may be all right, but it may not give them the best results.
So what can we do about this then?
Well, we tried to get a question asked in the House of Commons about it recently, and it almost was asked, but, you know, there's been this Brexit thing going in the background, so everything's been put on hold, it seems to me. But we want someone to do a really in-depth look at it, to look at, you know, to safeguard patients, and that's the key thing. And people might say, oh, yeah, you're a plastic surgeon, you just want to do it. I don't... Actually, there's lots of work for everybody, but you should have to reach a certain standard to be able to do that. We're going through this thing called credentialing, which is the Royal Colleges, if you're a doctor, to make sure that you understand how to talk to patients, you make you understand how to deliver their treatment and whatever. But it doesn't really, it's still going to miss out lots of people who will just do this stuff.
Do you hate the fact that you're lumped in with all the cowboys?
Yes. I do, and I think... You know, I think all we can try and do is do things, try and educate the public and try and tell them actually what's out there to be a bit more discriminating about it. But I know that's a really hard, because a lot of patients will do that, but a lot of patients won't. They'll want the same things, and they say, well, why can't I have it? And they'll, you know, I'm not being rude, they have a price point and think, well, I can't afford to do that. I can afford to do this. And if it works out, fine. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But those are the people, you know, it's like appraising doctors. Most people are fine. It's the Harold Shipmans you've got to catch, really. And they're the ones that always slip through the net. So, you know, perhaps putting Botox and fillers on prescription, which means that there'd be some way of regulating who was cashing a prescription, might be one way of doing it. I mean, Botox is at the moment, but fillers aren't. You could probably order them on the internet. I think having some sort of charter that, you know, you a patient felt they could ask 5 points. What's your training? Have you ever had a complication? How do I get you out of hours? You know, what happens if things go wrong? What's my, you know, if you, if I don't think it's worked, what are you going to do? You know, having five simple questions that people think they could go to people and say, you know, but do it in a way, you know, everyone's in media all the time, and, you know, different sorts of media. I mean, I grew up with the Green Cross Code and Tufty and all that, but, you know, we don't make any, you don't make enough of public information yet. You can do it in millions of how we're doing things now, you know, what we're doing at the moment. So perhaps being a bit more out there with it and saying, you know, you ask the patients, the people that are doing this, ask them, you know, have they done, ask them these simple questions. And it might encourage people to do it a bit more. The more times you say it, the more people are likely to do it.
I have to say, you've operated on me twice.
You're actually walking again.
Twice, I'm still walking. I was a kid of the 80s, so I was got sunburnt a lot when I was a kid, so I'm paranoid about skin cancer, and I have moles on me, and I had them checked. And whenever the skin doctor says they're a little bit, oh, let's just check that one, and fortunately they've all been benign, but I go to Simon, that you're recommended, to get them cut off. Very professional. How is skin cancer at the moment? Because I remember a while ago it was massively on the rise because people are still not heeding staying out of the sun warnings.
Yeah, I think skin cancer is still increasing. You know, in some countries, Australia, they are very strict. You have people go around on the beaches, and you get fined if your kids haven't got sunscreen and hats on and stuff. Certainly, the incidence, I think, is rising in younger people, and it's actually not necessarily exposure. Being lots of times, it may be somebody who's just gone abroad, you know, once or twice, who develops a mole, who then, you know, something happens to that mole. So I think you've really got to look after your skin. And, you know, the sort of dichotomy is that, you know, people want to plump up their skin to make it look good, and they want to tan at the same time. The sort of the two don't really go together. If you want to look after your skin, actually, yeah, you can go in the sun, but don't go in the middle of the day. Go in and put lots of sunscreen on, and then when you've been in the sun, lots of after sun. Because if you go in the sun and spend all your day baking, you look good for the time being, but as you age, your skin will thin and get much more wrinkly much more quickly. So then you'll start having to hit on all the other treatments that you've been trying to avoid, the Botox and fillers. So I think looking after your skin when you're young, I think you should do, because the, you know, things that are happening in the climate and the atmosphere, you don't, can't do much about, and that's only protecting us less, if you like, from the harmful sun's rays. So you've got to do something yourself, and that's slapping a whole load of stuff on it and not baking out there, really.
That message is not getting across, is it? That really isn't. I mean, again, we're going back to Love Island. It's very topical because it's on the moment, but they're basically people lying out in their bikinis and swim shorts all day long. They're getting browner as the weeks go on, and they seem to be spending a lot of time in the sunshine. I'm not having a go at Love Island, by the way. It's very entertaining. I've not become addicted this year, but in previous years I have, because it's quite entertaining. But it doesn't seem to be that. That's the message is still brown is beautiful, the tan is beautiful,
I think, you know, a lot of those tans, I would argue that they are not spray on or not artificial. Actually, they're a little bit too Strictly Come Dancing, to be quite honest, those tans.
Right, okay.
A bit on the orange side.
Right. Okay. The skin doctor I was talking about earlier, the one who told me about the Botox, he did say when he was about to retire, we know him, but I won't mention him, but he did say what was quite interesting was how the industry, I said, are you glad you're retiring? He goes, no, because he said the way the growth of the industry now is, you mentioned earlier, stem cells and things like that. He goes, it's now becoming off the scale how much it's moving.
And I think it's really exciting. I think, you know, we're talking about those for rejuvenation, for you know, making you look younger. But of course, the big thrust of those is treating cancers, treating other conditions, you know, sort of premature aging and whatever. So I think it is really exciting. It's, you know, I think it's a bit like, you know, if you got everything left in the fridge, you bung it together, you could probably make a Jamie Oliver casserole. If you, you know, with inflammation and wound healing and stem cells, if you bring everything together, you might get a Mary Berry souffle, but you might end up with a pancake. And we're not quite at the souffle level, but we're getting there.
It's getting there, though. It is exciting, isn't it?
It's very exciting. I think it is, because I think, you know, there's sort of vaccines for tumours. There are innovative drug treatments, because we're really getting into the DNA. So these very clever treatments that are very highly specific, you know, for treating all sorts of things. So I think the next 10 years, I think, will change the face of medicine completely.
So I suppose it must be quite satisfying for you, though, when you have a patient come in, and especially one of those children who have really deformed, and then you see their lives afterwards, they're human again, or you've got someone who's got a real problem with the size of their nose or something, and you give them a nice nose, and it must be an amazing feeling.
It is, and I sometimes feel guilty how good it makes you feel, but it's like, you know, winning the lottery when you, you know, you do something and people come and say thank you, or I've been able to live my life. And, you know, I had a very lovely lady today who's got a condition called hemifacial atrophy, where your body sort of, if you like, eats away, but actually dissolves the soft tissues of your face. And so you end up looking very skeletal and very deformed. And she worked in the health as a secretary, but used to have a sort of hair covering the side of her face. And today she comes in, hair's all pinned back. She's an NHS patient, and it's an autoimmune disease, so she had some autoimmune treatment and various things. We've done some fat grafting, and, you know, a couple of rounds of that, it's a pretty straightforward treatment. But actually, you know, she says, I can go out, I'm going on holiday this year, I bought a bikini, you know. She said, I know you think it's silly. I said, no, I don't. It's wonderful to hear that. You know, it's really uplifting to hear that people can just be normal. That's what they want, to just be normal.
So what do you think about people getting plastic surgery on the NHS? Where does it start and where does it stop? Because that's been controversial recently with some woman, I can't remember her name now, who'd got a nose job or something on the NHS because she said she had depression, and then went, I didn't really, but it was a way of getting it for free. Something like that, was it? I think.
Yeah. Well, I think that I'm sure that does happen. I mean, it's quite strictly funded, actually. I mean, you know, some of the things you think, well, of course you get that, you know, kids who've got prominent ears. Northwest London, we can't get funding for kids to have prominent ear surgery. They go to a psychologist, they go get school reports, they do personal statements.
What does prominent ears mean? Sticky out
ears, right, okay. And actually, if you're, you know, a kid at school, you get picked on, it's hard. You know,
definitely.
Kids get very bullied.
Yeah.
And one child, you know, I can think of it, last year we operated on, actually got our chief executive allowed us to do the surgery because this child actually tried to cut his own ear off. It was so, you know, these are real problems. They're not just simple things. So those things, there should definitely be permission for those. There has to be some sort of threshold. Not everybody's going to have it. And that makes a tremendous difference. These kids just become normal kids then. They're just playing football and being cheeky and sticking their fingers up like everybody else do, rather than the kid that doesn't want to go to school, hides in the corner and starts, you know, not performing or doing things, and that's destructive. But I think some people are quite evangelical about it. You know, oh, well, you've got one breast smaller than the other. Well, that's just the way you are. But actually, if you're that girl or you're that young woman, it's terrible. Mm. You know, you can't, you don't, you know, you might, you don't even watch Love Island because you know those girls haven't got that problem. You don't want to socialise. And actually, you know, sometimes it's one operation which might cost a few thousand pounds, but then it's the end of it. You know, the child then gets over it, and actually the young adult and becomes, you know, can do what they want to do. So I think people are very stupid. But if it's just purely aesthetic surgery, there's no money for that. And, you know, you get people sitting in the waiting room of my NHS clinics, you know, there are people there with all sorts of congenital problems and issues or traumas or tumours and whatever. And they come in and say, well, I just really want this, you know. I say, well, you're not going to get it, you know. And I try to head them off before they even come in, because, you know, you end up with a very long consultation, talking, getting really nowhere, and it's very disheartening. And yet I feel like saying, come with me, what about these people? You know, and I know you shouldn't compare one thing to another, but there's a blindness to it. They just don't see it. They can only... And those people, actually, psychology is the best way to help them. If they engage it, it might be quite useful.
Yeah.
If they're truly body dysmorphic, then There's nothing much you can do. But surgery is the worst thing to do for them.
But I think it's because I've talked to you about this before. I went to sit. I actually sat in the chair. My listeners know this, to have a hair transplant. But I realize, I'm not saying I'm not going to have it, by the way. And when they can clone the hairs, I probably will. But yeah. At the moment, I'm losing my hair rapidly, so I'll just have to keep going back, and I don't want to. But I realized that I was doing it for the wrong reasons for me. Yeah. Even though I wanted to look aesthetically better, I wanted the full head of hair, I wanted the full head and look great. I was doing it because I'd got myself, I was in a bad place. I wasn't thinking straight. I was out of a relationship, single. I'm getting older in TV. It was
all those things.
I had to work on what was going on in my head, you know. And I'd say I'd still love to have a full head of hair.
Me too.
But I'm more comfortable with who I am now. So it's sort of changed. So there is that, I suppose, the element to all these things
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think the NHS is not the avenue for that. Obviously, I mean, if you've got burns or you've lost your hair because you've had a terrible injury, there may be, the NHS may fund some of those things, and that's fine. I think, sometimes they're fairly small things you do for patients. Somebody will come and you may, I guess I do aesthetic rhinoplasties or things like that. But the way to do it is not to say, right, yeah, you want to know, it's fine, we'll book it. But, you need to get to know your patients and they need to get to know you. And so you need to spend quite some time talking to them about themselves and get to know them, because what you're doing is it's going to change what they look like forever, and that might be detrimental. I mean, sometimes people might look in the mirror and think, bloody hell, what's happened? And I think we always say you should have at least two appointments, you'd have a cooling off period, two weeks apart.
Good.
Never rush into it. Somebody comes, I want to surgery, I'm only here for a week, then don't do it. Don't do it. Because if you do it, and I'm always saying this to my young doctors and trainees, if you do it, it might be okay, it might be fine. But if it isn't, you've got nowhere to go back. Yeah. And the patient will always say, well, I didn't really, I was pushed into it and I didn't really want this. And actually, it's not good for any of you. Aesthetic surgery is difficult getting it right. You've got to really find out what patients want and try and do it. It doesn't always work out. Sometimes it doesn't, you don't get the right things right. But the more time you spend using photographs, using 3D pictures, all these sort of things, the more likely to. And actually, occasionally patients, I've had a couple of patients who, you're saying, did I ever turn patients away? I think they've turned me away,
Oh, really?
Well, that we've seen them and they've gone through it. They said, I'm glad that you've talked to me about it. I think it's not for me and I'm not going to do it. And fine, that's a good outcome. At least, you have to view it like that.
So, I come along with a picture of Brad Pitt and go, look, I'm not a million miles away, Simon. Come on, how can you?
How much money have you got?
Yeah. But then something like that, you go, oh, come on, this is not a haircut you're doing here.
That raises alarm bells in all sorts of ways. So, then I think you'd be having long discussions and you'd be wanting to know what the backstory was. And it may take a few visits to get that.
Okay.
And that's the way to do it.
My friend's an eye surgeon and he makes loads of money doing his eye surgery. However, his favourite thing is the NHS work he does. He just loves it. And he says the NHS is just the greatest.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it just seems...
Because you're working with a great team of people. You have the ability to teach people. You work with a great nurse, there's another doctor, there's a whole team. It's, I was at a clinic this afternoon and we ran a bit late, but, people stay and you have to give everyone the time. Some people take a few minutes, some people take a lot longer, but it really, it has a really good feeling about it. And I think patients feel, patients love the NHS. It's one of the last decent things we've got left, I think, to be quite honest.
Oh, it is, yeah.
Everyone's, I think, proud of the NHS. And, it gets a lot of knocking, but, the amount of trauma that goes on that people get treated, cancer treatments, really is fantastic, actually.
I could just see you talking about it. I can't tell you. I've spoken to you before. You love your job because you're doing nice things for people, and it's. I think you're lucky if you get a job like that. I remember interviewing a musician on my show, and she was training to be a doctor, and she pulled out to become a musician. I won't mention which one, and she ended up winning a Grammy or something. Yeah. And I didn't say it as a joke. I went, "Are you bit gutted that you didn't carry on becoming a doctor?" Because to me, medicine is the ultimate profession, because you're literally helping other human beings. And everyone in the studio laughed like that was ridiculous. Why would you want to be a doctor rather than a massive pop star? But I just see that. I've never met anyone in medicine. They moan about the hours.
Yeah. But I think we work harder than anybody else. I mean, you work hard. Everybody works hard. It's just a different sort of thing. Mm. Okay, he doesn't work hard.
No, I don't.
Is that Burnley on a Sunday?
one day a week, I do.
No, I think you're right. You know, it's. I think a lot of young doctors are becoming very disenchanted with it, and the reason I think that is that, you know, when we started off, you did work long hours, but we lived in doctors' messes, and so you lived in, you cooked for each other. If you had a problem patient, you'd discuss it. And now the training is so much that you work in a shift work. So patients don't know, you know, what's going on. Are they looking after me? And doctors come on, they may work sort of 6 hours. They take over a patient halfway through the treatment. They leave before the end of it. They don't feel part of it. And the number of young doctors leaving medicine is at an all-time high. And that's an absolute tragedy.
It's terrible.
And I think it's because we've altered the training so much, there's no camaraderie, they feel anxious about making decisions, they don't feel supported, and actually that's awful, actually.
And how's the suing culture going down in medicine? I remember when my I don't know whether you know this or not, my brother died of cancer when he was 37. I remember at the time someone saying, because he was diagnosed late, but he did have pancreatic cancer, which is quite a terrible, aggressive cancer, as you know, and it's quite fatal. I remember at the time after he died, someone saying to me, "Are you going to sue?" And I'm like, "What? Well, who am I suing?" And they're like, "Well, the doctor who didn't say it." Like, no, the doctor didn't go to work that day to misdiagnose my brother, and so he died.
No
one's doing that. No. I mean, there are the shipments, as you say, but generally, people are just trying their best.
I think they're true. And, you know, we're only human. You know, that's the thing. We are humans. And actually, everybody, I'm afraid, makes mistakes. You know, I'm not saying, you know, the wrong arm's come off. That's a pretty tragic mistake and a terrible mistake. But, you know, sometimes things don't go as well. And that's why getting to know your patients, trusting them trusting you. If you have a difficult time, you don't shoo your patient. You have to go through it with them together. Right, okay. Things are difficult. You know, I've had young patients, teenagers that have died, and you feel part of that family for quite a time and quite a time afterwards. And that's very hard. You can't shy away from that. If you're going to take on the job, you've got to take the responsibilities, and the sometimes bad times that go with it.
We've got a brain surgeon coming on in a couple of weeks. I mean, going into a brain is something else. I'm reading his book at the moment. Yeah. And every time he goes in, he's basically, you know, that close to killing a patient every time.
I worked with a brain surgeon who's a fantastic guy, and they're all slightly wacky brain surgeons. I don't know what it is, but they're great. I work with lots of, they're brilliant people. And but it is the most, you know, when we're doing these things with children's heads, and their heads are about this big, and you're taking the bones off, and you see the brain through these transparent layers of tissue. There's something really, it's like being a cathedral. It's like, you know, there's a bit of hush. It's sort of, there's something really quite mystical and magical about it, actually. It's quite amazing.
Do you like the operating theatre?
Yeah, I love it, actually. Yeah, I do. It's a good environment. It's, you know, I know lots of surgeons turn up the rock music and whatever. I mean, we're chatting and doing things, but it is good. I mean, you're there to do something, and you've got to do it, and you can't mess around or whatever. But no, because you plan things very carefully, and then, you know, you're going through them, and I think I do.
It was very, what you did to me was very minor, but I felt just like I trusted you implicitly both times. It's just been like, oh yeah, this guy knows what he's doing. And I think bedside manner is very important, isn't it?
You know, you're there to reassure the patient. Yeah. They're anxious. They say they're not. They're anxious because somebody's doing something, they don't know them very well, and you're sticking a knife in and doing nasty things. So you're there to support them and give them confidence, and if you know, have confidence yourself so that it goes well.
There are questions I ask everyone who comes to my podcast, so I'll have a go with you. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
I think give people a chance, actually. You know, I think we're all very quick to jump in and only going to sue that doctor, only, you know, and I've done it myself when I was younger. I was probably a bit like that, but now, you know, you sit down, you listen to somebody, and just don't answer, just take a deep breath and answer, because sometimes, you know, you meet medicine, all sorts of, you know, I met a lovely Syrian doctor today, I'm trying to help him do some retraining. You meet all sorts of people, and don't jump to conclusions about people either, you know. You just let people tell your story, and just I suppose I'm being a bit more tolerant, and actually I try to be tolerant, but I think, you know, with where you do with other people, you don't really know them, just give them a chance. And I think we're all too quick to criticize and jump on people and slag them off, and perhaps that's a TV cut, I don't know, sort of culture, but it's not very healthy.
Yeah.
And actually, it doesn't breed any happiness at all, actually. It doesn't make anybody happy.
Are we still leading the way in medicine over here?
Yeah, I think we are at the moment. I think we are right up there with Western Europe and North America, certainly, very much so, yeah. And I think, you know, there's lots of collaboration. You know, lots of the best is not just us, it's us doing these big studies or sharing our work or talking about it. You know, Brexit might change that because it will limit some of our access to resources and trials and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, we're, you know, highly respected. And actually, you know, there's a great medical community around the world and people speak to each other and swap ideas and things.
Do they? Does medicine open source? Because obviously technology, apart from Elon Musk, everyone's going, oh, let's hide all our technology because we'll make money. Are you guys open sourcing, saying, hey, I tried this and it worked? And
I've been part of a trial looking at a drug to treat neurofibromatosis, these children, these big facial swellings. And that's a world center study run through all over. Perhaps going to find out, going to talk about it in San Francisco this year, some of the things we've been doing. But yeah, I think for those sort of things, people are very open about it. People want to, people want to share ideas. And, you know, it's to try and benefit all patients, really, trying to do the best. I don't think people really do hide things away. And so many, you know, studies now are world studies. You know, there's an issue at the moment which people may have heard about, and that's relying on breast implants. And those things hit the press, and it's going to be in a dispatches program next week called BIA-ALCL, which is a type of tumor that's been found to arise on the capsules of some breast implants. Now, you know, if people are listening to that, they're not going, oh my God, I'm going to get them taken out. It's a very rare thing that's happened. Right. It seems to be on implants that are textured, that have a sort of ruffled surface. And the incidence is about 1 in 38,000, whereas the incidence of breast cancer is 1 in 8 women. Mm. And but this is a new thing that's come up, and it's only by studies in Asia, Europe, America and Australia that it's really come to light. So it's been a really collaborative thing that's happened to outline this new thing that we really haven't discovered. I think there's been 400 cases since 1997.
Right.
Yeah, okay. There's been millions and millions and millions of breast implants. So not to freak anybody out, but if you're a doctor and or a patient going to see a doctor, then as a duty of candor, you should be telling your patients about these things to help them make the decisions about what they're doing. And it's not to frighten people, but it is something slightly unusual that's been happening.
I listen to a lot of podcasts and too many. And so I understand that there's people thinking that this is an unfair question to ask. You should just ignore me if you don't answer it. But there's stuff going on down in China where they're sort of sewing men's heads on dogs and things all day. They're doing strange. They're creating strange things. Yeah. Is there any truth in the fact that they're messing about with?
Well, that sounds rather like sort of Second World War and you know, Mengele and all those sort of things, because that certainly went on there. Do you know, I don't know. I have to say, it wouldn't totally surprise me if it was happening in some parts of the world. I'm not saying there specifically. I think, you know, here in the UK, things are regulated, whether it's researching embryos or spare tissue or whatever. You know, for people who still think that killing tigers and snorting their bones and is the right thing to do and make you live forever, then I would have thought that was probably quite appropriate, you know, that sort of thing they may do. But who really knows? It's such a big country, it's unfathomable what happens there, really. And we'll never find out.
What's the biggest mistake you've made? I think I might change that question. What's the biggest mistake you've made and you've learned from, maybe? I don't know. But what's the biggest mistake you made? You don't have to say it's in surgery or anything. But.
Yeah, well, there's this one patient. You probably see them on this bloke who's got one leg. No. I don't know. I think, you know, you make little mistakes all the time, and I don't people say, bloody hell, what's this guy doing? But, you know, life is a bit like walking on paving stones. Yeah. You're trying to avoid the cracks all the time, really, aren't you? There's nothing I think, God, that's terrible. I wish I'd never done that. I sometimes think, well, if I'd got my A-levels, I'd have been a doctor 10 years longer, but I wouldn't have done dentistry, and I really enjoyed doing that. I don't know. I'm not just being facetious and clever and not saying, because I've sort of done lots of really stupid things, but there's nothing that haunts me. There's nothing I think, you know. I didn't speak to my dad before he died because I forgot to make a phone call. You know, that's not a mistake. Right. It's a regret. But I don't have anything that I think, wow, that's a really bad thing I did.
Isn't dentistry all about glue? nowadays, isn't it? I've got a friend who's a dentist in America, and he ended up just talking to a lot of people about different glues a lot, because, you know,
a lot of my mates who did dentistry have all given up. I mean, because they've gone into other things. I mean, you know, I like talking quite a lot, and actually you can have a one-way conversation doing dentistry, but it's, you know, nice weather. Ooh, yeah, I thought you said, you know, there's nothing much you can say, really.
I love my dentist, but he does talk to me about football whilst he's got stuff in my mouth, yeah.
But I think, you know, again, that's somewhere where technology, there's little CT scans, there's dental implants, material science, fantastic.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, actually, one of the saddest things, I was lead of paediatrics at Chelsea and Westminster. We were still taking kids' teeth out for dental decay. Because certain parts of Northwest London, there is no dental health. People have very poor oral hygiene. And in this day and age, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is.
There's no fluoride in the water in the UK, apart from in Anglesey. It's banned because people say it's against civil liberties to put fluoride in the water. I mean, there's antibiotics, a load of other crap, but there's no... It's bonkers. It gives you stronger bones. It gives you stronger teeth. It, you know, if you get dental decay, then you may be more likely to get heart disease. So, you know, it's a bizarre thing.
Yeah, but in America, they want it taken out, don't they?
They're just I don't know. I mean, each state is different, right, as you know. But
okay.
But anyway, it's but dentistry has become much about material science now.
Yeah, it has. Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah. Any life hacks? Maybe travel tips or something like that, or how to cook something, or
I can make good risotto.
Can you?
Yeah.
What's the key?
Time. You need 20 minutes.
Time.
20 minutes. I don't have this thing I make if we're, you know, up on it. I always got some rice in the fridge, some frozen peas and prawns, and it's dead easy.
Right.
Works really well.
Have you got any hacks on your skin? Do you know that all that cream we stick on our skin, you know, is it actually doing anything to us?
Most of it is complete rubbish. I know that people say, well, you know, 8 out of 10 people say it looks better, but with a glass of wine in your hand, probably anything looks better. But most of it, I mean, actually, okay, skin hacks. The best sunscreens are probably not allowed to use. Boots. Buy them at the airport. They're cheap. You can buy 2 for 1 at the airport. Leave them on holiday. Have to bring them back again. Always put the sunscreen on in the morning. You get out of bed before you go, you know, go for a pee, before you go out and whatever, put it on your skin. But the really good thing is buy the big blue tubs of After Sun, which is aloe vera. Put it on at night time. It's fantastic. Cools your skin. It makes you look radiant. It's brilliant. So, you know, looking after your skin. And actually, all these moisturizers, most of it, you know, your skin is a waterproof layer. You know, if it rains, it doesn't sink into your skin. You don't go soggy. And actually, most of the stuff doesn't permeate the skin. Your skin's a very effective defense barrier against heat, chemicals, all sorts of things. Aqueous cream, which is as cheap as chips, it's about the same size as your tub of collagen. You get one for about £1.
Yeah.
You know, put it on your skin. It's as good as anything. And actually, if you're on holiday, you can take it with you. You can use it as shower gel. Use it as shampoo. It moisturizes your skin. Cheaper the better. It's nothing else is as cheap as that, and nothing does any more than that.
And what about exfoliating? Because I think someone came on Sunday brunch once, and I discussed that with them, and they said maybe not the greatest idea, because you're supposed to have dead skin to protect you from the elements and everything else.
Well, you're scratching all the dead skin off, but actually in doing it, you're probably causing a bit of inflammation as well. So if you get inflammation, you increase blood supply to the top layer of the skin, and probably when you go in the sun, you burn more quickly. And, you know, you often see people exfoliate a lot. They look slightly shiny. They look as though someone's gone over them with a bit of satin varnish. You know, it's not a great look, really, because your body's massively trying to produce oil to compensate for all the stuff you've scrubbed off. So, and nobody's skin is, you know, it's never all oily or all dry. You know, different bits of your skin behave in different ways. So I think the peels, all those sort of things are damaging. That, yeah, you get a quick fix because everything tightens up a bit, it looks a bit good for a bit, the buff puff things or whatever you're using on your skin, but actually in the long term it's probably not great.
I saw someone the other day had like a little machine, they were doing little dots all into their
Dermaroller skin. yeah that's very popular. So you can either add a little wheel, add little blades in, and you run it across, and it's thought by damaging the dermis by going through the top layer, that the on your skin, a bit like my shirt, the epidermis is the top, the dermis is the layer underneath. If you go into that bit, which has all the collagen and all the juicy bits in, if you stimulate, they produce more collagen. And people have done, you know, looked at it, done biopsies and things. There's a little bit of evidence, but not masses.
Someone once told me, a wise man once told me that you should moisturize from within, as in drink lots of water and stay hydrated. Definitely. Is that right? Yes, it says you drinking a beer.
No, you're right. Lots of water. I mean, water's very good. I mean, if your body, if you take too much, your body will get rid of it, you know, so you're flushing your kidneys out or whatever. But it does, you know, if you're, you know what it's like, if you've been out, had a heavy night out, you feel terribly dehydrated. A sort of big fry up's good, but actually, when you put the fluid back in, when it gets back into your system, and an old-fashioned hangover cure used to be just have a drip in your arm, a couple of litres of fluid, you feel better very quickly because you're putting all the fluid back around the cells. You're not so dehydrated.
That industry, though, the makeup and the sort of moisturiser. I was in Boots the other day, knowing you were coming on. I was just looking around at all the stuff in the women's section down there. There's every bottle which is promising all these things. It's such a multi-billion pound industry, isn't it? It's absolutely huge.
It is. And actually, you know, it's sort of money for all rope, really. Because I'm sure if you looked, I know they say, well, the dermatologically test and all this sort of stuff. But I think a lot of the stuff is not changed. The bottles are a bit different. It's a bit more pricey. You know, it's branded. There's somebody who's well-known promoting it. But I don't think there's very much evidence. I mean, if you look at a lot of the stars promoting creams and things, if you see the photographs of them and see them in real life, you can't quite believe it's the same person. They're very airbrushed and touched up, actually. Yeah. I know they say this is not touched up, but I'm afraid they are, or the lighting, you know, it's like people do the Instagram where you hold your camera in different ways. It shows your face up. I think there's lots of hype about it. And I you know, I think people like to do it. Okay, it's probably not harmless because nothing much is going to happen either way, except it's expensive to do all this stuff. But I don't, you know, I think probably the best things for eye bags are still hemorrhoid ointment, to be quite honest.
Hemorrhoid?
It's an old wives' tale that you use hemorrhoid because it causes vasoconstriction. So it constricts the blood vessels in your skin. It's meant to tighten the skin up. You know, I've had various patients have told me they over the years they've done that. And I thought, fair enough, you know. Well, I'll just sell you a jar of hemorrhoid cream in that case. But I think a lot of the stuff people put in the skin is not. You know, it doesn't get anywhere. It just stays on the skin. If it makes you feel better, then you could argue
it's
that's
a lot to do with placebo. Yeah,
it's all placebo effect, yeah. And perception,
which is probably makes your skin puff out a bit if you're feeling happy. Some it's interesting because some of the people who turn up on my show don't look like they're publicity shots.
Yeah.
And I always think, look ugly in your publicity shots. So when people meet you in real life, they go, wow, you're better looking. Where is it? the real life interaction is better than the one going, oh, disappointment, you know.
Jesus, but,
yeah, exactly right. All right, final couple of questions. Can you recommend a book?
I mean, actually, I'm not sure it's a person that's going to come on, but there's a book I give to all my registrars, a great book called Do No Harm.
Right.
By Henry Marsh, who's a neurosurgeon. And there's a big genre. There's lots of doctors writing books now.
Yeah.
Some are brilliant, actually. And you know, I think of Rob Buckman, who's one of the first ones years ago writing those corny jokes. But Henry Marsh, a neurosurgeon, he worked at Atkinson Morley's. He's just written another book. And this book is about, you know, one's failings as a doctor, you know, the things that you think would go well and don't, and how it makes you feel. And it's very self-critical. And actually, I think it's a good book for doctors to read, certainly, because I think it gives you some humility, and that's what you've got to have. But it's a very good read as well, actually.
It's funny, isn't it? They call it the operating theatre because it used to be a theatre. People used to pay to come and watch doctors, like hack up patients and do whatever.
Well, there's the other book I was going to say, it's probably a medical book, and I can't remember who wrote it now, but it's called Surgery, the Butchering Art. And, you know, it's about surgery at, I suppose, the 1800s, where literally, you know, the smell was so disgusting.
Yeah.
And the wards and the morgues were outside and the rotting corpses. They couldn't understand why patients weren't recovering. And people would have their frock coats on.
Yeah.
They wouldn't wash their hands, even if they had a sandwich, or they wouldn't wash their hands. They'd just wipe them on their coat and then go straight from cutting up a dead body to try and do an operation on a live one. And, you know, the most bizarre thing is some of the patients actually survived these operations. And they were horrific things. You know, there were people who could do amputations. That was a famous thing, you know, the quickest amputation, the assistant lost two of their fingers, but people could do these amputations within a few minutes. And of course they had to, because there's no other way of stopping the blood. If you didn't, they'd bleed to death. And they had very funny, there's a Pepys and Daniel Defoe were friends, I think, and they both suffered from bladder stones, so drinking too much port and stuff. And there was one operation which they both had several times, which involved you had to get very drunk. And then they stuck up a, what they did is they tied you to a chair, basically, and they got a probe with a hook on and stuck it up in your perineum, which is between your balls, if you're a bilineal, if you're, and actually stuck it right in, into your bladder and pulled the stone out.
Oh, my God, Jesus.
And actually, because these people couldn't pee because their bladder's so, their lands would pee. But, you know, the thought of it is mind-numbingly awful. But, you know, Daniel Defoe, you know, who wrote Robinson Crusoe, had this about two or three times because he had so many stones. I mean, you know.
Oh, my God.
So we've moved on a bit.
Yeah. Well, my kids told me that there was a guy, I can't remember his name now, there was a guy that they'd learned it, who was talking about germs and saying there's these little things which live there. And they thought he was nuts.
Yeah, this is the same, it's Lister. Actually, this book is about Lister. And it's about, he used this spray which he introduced in theatres. And the Germans said, it's absolutely rubbish. You know, there's nothing at all. You know, they didn't believe it's all complete rubbish. And that's absolutely right.
Lindsay Fitzharris is the name of the book.
Lindsay Fitzharris. Yeah. Have you read it?
No, I've heard about it.
It's brilliant. Yeah. It's very good. Don't read it on a full stomach, though.
What's it
called? Or if you're feeling queasy. Surgery, The Butchering Art. Right. It's a brilliant book. I'll get you a copy. It's a really good book. Really good.
Final question. What's the meaning of life? The easy one.
Oh, Jesus. I think it's about, you know, humanitarianism. We all got to help each other. You know, what goes around comes around. And if, you know, people have bad times, whether it's war, whether it's awful injuries, whether it's psychological problems. You know, if you can't help other people out, you're the same species, then what can you do, really? A bit of compassion.
Great answer. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was really fascinating, interesting stuff. And let's hope we get some regulations in soon.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Feels like we need it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Cheers, Simon.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
I thought that went extremely well. I learned so much from the interview.
Yeah, I really liked Simon. I thought he was great. Oh, should I say Mr. Eccles, sorry. mate Si, who I've only met once.
When I had my moles removed with him, he's such a lovely guy that it genuinely is. We have conversations, we sit and talk about stuff, and that's when I thought, it'd be a great idea to get him on the podcast because he knows so much and he's so interested in regulations and things like that. So I thought that was fascinating. But also his mannerisms, it's really interesting when you're a patient under there because you're going in and having a bit of your skin cut off, but it's just, he's so confident and so reassured. And I know this sounds a bizarre thing to say, it was a good experience because you feel like you're being dealt with by professional. So
it was this podcast, you know, these episodes are my very favorites, when someone is knowledgeable, passionate, and obviously a kind and considerate person. You can hear all of that, can't you? So I really enjoyed that.
If you get a chance, go to Facing the World website and have a look at that charity, because their work they're doing is phenomenal. These poor kids around the world, they have such massive deformities, and these guys go in and they help them and literally change their lives. It's a fantastic charity, but just to see what they can do is phenomenal. Very interesting stuff. So Mark, I think I'm going to buy you some plastic surgery.
Thanks, Tim. What am I going to get?
You know that stuff in China where they put your head on a dog? That a cat. I'm going to merge you with a cat because you love cats so much.
I wouldn't mind that.
Yeah, you can sit there, you know, I don't know.
But instead, you know, it's the opposite to that, the famous cat lady who has the cat. Like, I'll have a cat body, but a big bald, stupid head with glasses.
You'll have your head on a cat body. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Can I still talk, or do I have to meow everything?
I'm going to let you keep your vocal cords.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
So you can just walk around talking. Where's that scene actually haunts me from, is it Day of the Triffids? Where, I think it's that, where ends up with a head of a dog on a head of a man on a dog's body. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. No.
I think it was that or something. I don't know. It's where something dripped from the sky. Anyway, this scene, it was quite interesting. Anyway, this podcast is sponsored by Cooker, spelt Quooker, pronounced Cooker. Let me tell you about it. It's a tap in your kitchen. It's absolutely amazing. I absolutely love it. Thank you very much for them for sponsoring the podcast. You've got your normal hot water. You've got your normal cold water. You've got your filtered cold water. And you've got your 100 degree boiling hot water. And now, Mark's favourite thing about it, because he's drunk me out of bubbles already, is you've got chilled, sparkling, filtered water.
Like you don't use it as well.
I do use it a lot, but you've used all my bubbles. I've got no bubbles left. Now I'm going to have to change the canister. But no, it's fantastic, isn't it? It's just such a nice little treat having bubbled water. I thought it would be... Bubbled water.
I like the bubbled water either.
Gas. I just thought it would be a bit gimmicky. And now I just absolutely love it. But I'm a big fan of sparkling water anyway. So, and like yourself, Mark,
yes.
You seem to drink more sparkling water than you do normal water.
Yeah, I prefer the taste.
Do you?
Yeah.
Mm.
I find it quite addictive, actually. And as Mr. Eccles was saying, you can't drink too much water.
Moisturise from within.
You can't drink. He actually said, that's what he said, you can't drink too much water.
Though you can.
I don't think you can.
I think you can.
Oh, yeah, because you know more than someone who...
But wasn't that the case surgery? With all the kids on ecstasy? They were just... Wasn't that a thing?
That sounds like the LSD thing where people used to skin their arm because they thought it was an orange.
Yeah.
I
swear there was a thing where you could drown yourself because the ecstasy made you so thirsty that the clubbers were just gallons of water.
Mr. Eccles said that your body just gets rid of it if it needs to.
Yeah, I suppose so. We've also got to like to thank our friends at Beer 52, who are on board as well.
Yes, Beer 52. Claim your free case of craft beer. Just pay £5.95 postage. And go to beer52.com/lovejoy and get that free case.
It's so what eight happens, beers. Yeah,
you it's get... eight beers and a snack and a magazine, and you can cancel your subscription at any time.
Right,
is the most important.
So the
thing.
First one you get is free, and then after that you can cancel it or you can carry on the subscription.
Yeah.
Mark or myself absolutely love the subscription.
It's like Chris, you sent me a picture of the box of what arrived.
Yeah, I did.
And I text back. It's Christmas.
I did because we do. It is exciting.
Yeah.
I subscription services are great. I've got my chocolate one as well with Cocoa Runners, and that's really good as well. And I just do like it when it arrives, and you go, oh, exciting new flavors, new tastes. One of those exciting things to do, and I'm dubious about this because unlike Mark,
well, let me explain.
Oh, go on.
They're just to set up this beer.
Yeah,
this
every month is
a different theme, and this is the Boston Beer Party.
By the way, if you like one of the beers, you can go on the website and then order more in. So
we had one from this box on another podcast, and it was one of the best beers.
It was lovely. Yeah.
It was absolutely delicious. Yeah. So this is the Boston Beer Party month, and so this is all breweries from in and around Boston. And the one we
Boston
had
Boston in the Midlands or Boston
America? No, Boston in the US.
There is a Boston in the Midlands.
There is, right, yes.
My geography is appalling. Right, so the one we're going for now, and the thing about these is we try them, and basically it's hit and miss with me. I reckon I like 90% of them, but every now and then one will come along like a sour beer or something. It'll be like...
I don't think you're going to like this one.
Well, this is
I
it.
Think you're we're being doing, Mark, purposely provocative.
Mark likes 100% of the beers.
Yeah.
Is there any you haven't liked so far?
There's been ones that I wouldn't necessarily drink again, but I haven't disliked a single one.
I love beer, but not to the level. Because I love beer, but I like nice, like just... I like a good Guinness.
You like
I like a good
nice,
pale ale.
Bland
like, no, I
beer.
Don't.
I'm, nice,
maybe.
Bland.
But you'll go for all the weird, you know, like licorice and beaver flavour.
My brother,
something.
My brother got me into it, actually. He's really into craft ales and craft beers.
But,
and stuff.
I don't
and,
mind
and,
them, but
no. But when you start talking about it and listening to what goes into it and all that sort of stuff, I find it really interesting. That's. I'm going to have to
sour beers are horrible, right? This one's called Harpoon Dunkin' Coffee Porter, and is it connected to Dunkin' Donuts? Because it's in there.
It looks like the thing.
It's
I think
in their
they
logo.
I think they might have cheekily done something similar to that.
Okay, so it's coffee porter. So
this is going to be like a sort of quite sort of. I imagine this is going to be quite
dark,
a smooth
well, it is dark.
Sort of Guinness style beer.
Oh, I quite like that.
Oh, so, the smell of it's amazing. Smell that.
Yeah, it's
it just
really,
smells so nice, doesn't
it's
it?
It's got a coffee thing going on it. I like that coffee taste.
Oh, yeah.
What percent is that?
I think it's going to be quite strong. I can never find, you always ask me that. Here we are. Oh, six.
Six, yeah. You can taste that, can't you?
You can actually taste the booze in it.
Yeah.
Do it taste a little bit like a sort of Guinness with a, you know, other port stouts and porters are available. It tastes a bit like one of those with a shot of something like a coffee liqueur.
It's not, it's not as thick as a Guinness. It's more liquidy. Liquidy? Anyway, that's
well,
nice.
It's a porter. It's not a stout, isn't it? So it's slightly different.
Yeah.
Guinness is a stout, isn't it?
Yeah.
Am I right?
What's a porter?
Porter is a darker.
What is a, should we just...
Go have a quick look.
I'll have a quick...
Yeah, you have a quick look while I polish off the rest of that can.
You do that. You do that. Porter. Porter is a dark cellar beer developed in London. London! From well-hopped beers made from brown malt. Oh, so it's made from brown malt. Name was first recorded in the 18th century and thought to have come into its popularity with street and river porters.
Because that's where you get a porterhouse and that's where you get a porterhouse steak. Can you imagine a steak with that?
Oh, that's just delicious. That I'm really liking that. It's really good. Just different and nice. Okay, so if you want the subscription, go to...
So that's beer52.com/lovejoy and claim your free case of beer for $5.95 postage.
Oh, it's really good, that.
You've started singing your name again when you hear your own name.
It's get. Do you know what? I'm going to start talking about myself in the third person. I know it's a horrible thing
Please
to do, but no, I'm going to start doing it.
Sorry.
I really want to do this. This is actually, the more I'm drinking this, the more I'm liking it. It's actually delicious.
And of course, yes, you're also in that free case of beer, you get a snack and a magazine. And we have appeared in that magazine. So, you know, it's a quality but periodical.
Yeah. We're in the magazine with our shirts off.
Oh,
we
God, no.
Really. Right, that's it for this week's podcast. Thoroughly enjoyed that. I hope you did it too. Please, can you email me with any comments you want to discuss, anything to do with plastic surgery or anything to do with anything else? We're always looking for your problems for the mailbag editions. It's dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to tweet me, it's @TimLovejoy. So, yeah, please contact us.
I noticed on the can.
Yeah.
It's the brewery's Boston, Massachusetts in Windsor, and it's employee owned, so it's a good
so it's a cooperative.
There you go So even more reason to drink that beer.
Yay.
Harpoon,
fantastic. Harpoon Dunkin' Coffee Porter, brilliant. Alright, that's it for this brilliant.
That sip of beer's gone to your
head.
Until
I've had a drink. Yeah. We'll see you really soon. Peace and love, Joy.
Bye.